Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane while she's away on vacation. Former military analyst Daniel Ellsberg yesterday compared the recently released Afghanistan war logs with his leaking of the 1971 Pentagon Papers. This is what he said. The parallels are very strong, and thanks to the Internet, it has moved around the world much faster. Joining me in the studio to talk about how the disclosures could further complicate U.S.-Pakistan relations and what they might also mean for journalism. Eric Schmidt, one of the New York Times reporters who wrote the story, former acting director of the CIA, John McLaughlin, and John Barry, who covers defense issues for Newsweek. Welcome. Nice to have you all here. You can join our conversation at 1-800-433-8850. drshow@wamu.org is the email address. But before we get to the panel, we're delighted to have Representative Jane Harman of California with us on the phone. She chairs the Homeland Security Subcommittee of the Intelligence Committee in the House. Congresswoman Harman, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Steve.
What is, in your view, the significance of these leaks? We've been reading about them now for 24, 48 hours, but what's your take on the meaning of it?
Well, let me say first how much I'm going to miss my dear friend Dan Shore. I listen to Diane Rehm as much as I can during the week, but on the weekends, I always cared what Dan had to say about what our policy efforts meant. And I know his last report was 2 weeks ago. I'm going to have a hard time next Saturday listening without his voice there. So
I appreciate that comment, Jane. Thank you.
Back to this. The leaks in and of themselves are not that significant. As people have pointed out, there is not a lot of new information in them, and they end just as Obama's new strategy was implemented. But there are two questions, at least the way I see this. Number one is, how is the war going, and should we have a national debate? My answer to that is, it's not going very well, and yes, we should have a national debate. Second issue is leaking classified material an acceptable way to promote that debate? My answer to that is no. And when you look at this raw material, my staff went to WikiLeaks, not to the edited versions in the New York Times and other newspapers. There are names of soldiers, names of State Department personnel, names of towns in Afghanistan, and names of Afghan sources. And I think we've created a new enemies list for the Taliban, which not only endangers our people, but endangers Afghans. And that is why we classify material, to protect sources and methods. So I think the way this was done was unacceptable. The notion that we should have a debate on Afghanistan is totally appropriate.
Let me ask you this. You've raised some very interesting questions. One is, in your mind, given one of the headlines, certainly the one the New York Times stressed from these documents about the ongoing connections between the Pakistan Intelligence Service, the ISI, and the Taliban. As you point out, there's nothing really new about that, but these documents reinforced that strong impression of collaboration. Does that raise in your mind any questions about the reliability of our alliance with Pakistan and our reliance on this ally in that area?
Well, the leaks have very much angered Pakistan. Let's focus on the fact that Pakistan has 60 to 100 nukes and a weak government, although a stronger military operation in the government. And it is in the crosshairs of this question of whether we will be able to ultimately win or at least stabilize Afghanistan and prevent al-Qaeda from coming back there. So we have to address this. My sense, having made numerous trips there, is that our current relationship with ISI, I'd be very interested to hear what John McLaughlin says on the panel that follows this, our current relationship is quite straight. And Ahmed Pasha, who heads the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, whom I've met a number of times, is, by my lights, an honorable man. The material that was leaked mentions Hamid Gul, who's a former leader, who is denying that he ever played both sides, but certainly there has been publicly acknowledged reporting that he may have done this. And it is certainly true, from my personal observation, that the Pakistani government still needs to do more to crack down on the Haqqani network and other Taliban cells and organizations inside of Pakistan, which are harming Pakistan, but also fueling the insurgency against us and against those in Afghanistan who want to create stability there and keep al-Qaeda out. So, yeah, I think the Pakistani piece of the information is probably the most critical piece. We need to build a good relationship with Pakistan. It is in our national security interest. And let me just suggest one way forward, which I haven't seen in the reporting, and that is that Pakistan claims it is to the extent it's engaged in things in Afghanistan we don't like. It claims that it's worried we will leave, and then the Indians will move in. This Pakistani-Indian rivalry is a huge deal.
Well, it overwhelms all of Pakistan's thinking on.
And they view India as an existential threat. They have troops on the Indian border. Those troops, in my view, could be used more productively against the Taliban threat inside of Pakistan. But if we could work on Pakistan-India relations and try to settle that down, I think we would go a long way to fixing the real problem we have with Pakistan.
Now, let me ask you this question. In terms of public reactions and public acceptance of the war in Afghanistan, clearly opinion has been sliding against the war. Latest ABC Washington Post poll, 53% said the war was not worth it. Right there in the House of Representatives, the latest war funding bill narrowly passed by only 5 votes. Is this leak of documents with all of the information, not only about the collaboration with Pakistan, but about the killing of civilians and a lot of other damaging information, is this going to make it harder for this administration to sell its policy both to Congress and the American public?
Yes, but I don't think it's because of the leak. I think that, let me state my own view. I stated when President Obama announced the surge of troops that I was skeptical that a larger military footprint would work in Afghanistan, and I remain skeptical. But I also stated my view, and I think a lot of people share this view, regardless of how they feel about the surge, that in a time of constrained resources, no one is missing our, you know, exploding debt and deficit and high unemployment rates here, we need to put our counterterrorism dollars where they can do the most good. And I frankly think that much higher threats in the near term against U.S. interests and the U.S. homeland are in Yemen and parts of Africa. No one should miss the significance of the bombing the other day in Uganda in terms of al-Shabaab and what their intentions are. So I think that we can't sustain $100 billion plus in Afghanistan. We will need a new strategy, and it should be one where we stay in Afghanistan. No question about that, especially with respect to government-in-a-box ideas, which we haven't been able to fully implement, but that we reduce our military footprint and we surge some of our attention on much more troubling areas like Yemen.
Final question. We appreciate your being with us. And that is, given the public opinion turning against this war and given the fact that test votes have been very close, you see any possibility that Congress will resist further expenditures for the surge the president has talked about?
Well, 2 points there. We're going to vote, I think, today on the war supplemental. It was very controversial in the House because it added a lot of spending for some priorities which I favor, like education. Those pieces have been stripped out by the Senate. So the House will get a narrower bill. I mm-hmm. predict it will pass on the consent calendar today. That means it will get a two-thirds vote here. Mm-hmm. Most people are for making sure that troops in harm's way are protected, and I'm planning to vote for that. But in the next budget cycle, I don't think people will tolerate any more emergency supplementals. The war costs will have to be on budget, and I predict that before we get there, the administration, working with Congress and with an informed public, you know, I'm calling for a public debate, will come up with a revised strategy that spends our scarce resources more wisely.
Congresswoman Jane Harman. She is chairman of the House Homeland Security Subcommittee of Intelligence, Democrat from California. Congresswoman Harman, thanks so much for being with us on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you, Steve.
We appreciate it. John McLaughlin, since Ms. Harman mentioned you and she was anxious to know your views, let me turn to you first and get your reactions to what she said and in general, your reactions to the significance of these documents we've seen disseminated in the last day or two.
Well, Steve, I think Jane Harman has this about right. We're not learning anything particularly new. There's some granularity in all of this that we didn't perhaps see before in the public domain. But the themes are basically those that have been discussed widely in the press and so forth. Now, I think the significance of this is that it happened. In other words, I think we could all agree, everyone here, that in a war, there are some things that deserve to remain secret. The real question is, who gets to decide what remains secret and what doesn't? And this sets a terrible precedent in terms of someone making a decision independently to throw all this stuff out the door. Too soon to tell without going through it. Jane's staff appears to have gone through it in great detail. Too soon to tell exactly what level of damage there may or may not be here. So on the one hand, I'm someone who strongly believes in the importance of the press informing the public about public issues in a democracy where we, the people, make decisions. But there's a serious question, I think, about throwing all this stuff out the door. In terms of what Congressman Harman said about the ISI in Pakistan, the basic point I'd make is that dealing with them has always been complicated. And we have a pretty good relationship with them now.
Tom McLaughlin is the former acting director of the CIA. I have two journalists with me as well. We'll get to your calls and your comments. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. Our subject this hour is the massive leak of 90,000 documents related to the Afghan war that came out in the New York Times and other publications in the last day or two. Joining me to talk about this, Eric Schmidt, one of the reporters who did the stories for the New York Times, former acting director of the CIA, John McLaughlin, and John Barry, who covers defense issues for Newsweek. You can join us, 1-800-433-8850 or drshow@wamu.org. John Barry, from a substantive point of view, a lot of the focus has been on the leak, and I'm going to ask Eric in a minute to talk about how the New York Times dealt with it. But as a veteran defense correspondent, did you learn anything new from these documents?
I haven't read all 92,000.
Yes, fair enough.
You'll be surprised at that. But from the take that three disparate news organizations made, and I waded some into the WikiLeaks pile myself on the early hours of this morning, the answer is no. I didn't learn anything in substance that I didn't know before. What it does, as John McLaughlin was suggesting, is to fill in really minute and quite telling detail just how tough for unit after unit in Afghanistan the war has become. It also fills in just how strongly they felt through the last 5 years that they were under-resourced and underappreciated, and a mood of some despondency runs through a lot of the stuff that I read, and I think that's significant.
And Eric Schmidt, you were part of the team that processed this information from the New York Times over the last month. Give us your analytical take here. What came out at you primarily?
I think I agree with both my colleagues. I think the important thing we found here was this, the sheer volume of these reports. And as you wade through them and go through them carefully, as we did, you see just the day-to-day ground-level sense of what the soldier is seeing, the American soldier on the ground, the violence that goes in, day out, and how that violence picks up as the reporting continues. And these reports range from the beginning of 2004 till the end of last year. And you really get a sense that this mission on the ground in Afghanistan is beginning to spiral out of control. You also get a sense that you don't really, I don't think you can capture altogether in all the reporting, the day in, day out sense of helplessness that the average Afghan on the ground feels as well, where a child can be just run over by a truck in the street, a family could be shot up at a checkpoint. And while some of these incidents have been written up, of course, particularly when they reach really extraordinary levels, it's just the day in, day out, almost a senselessness of what's going on in the violence.
And do you have any sense that this will have an impact on public opinion? As I mentioned earlier, the trend is pretty clear. Americans increasingly believe the war is not worth it, a trend we saw in Iraq before, in public opinion before the war, before the election of 2008. There tended to be more support for Afghanistan because of the direct connection to 9/11 that was lacking in Iraq. But what's your sense of this?
Well, I think these reports land at an opportune time. It's certainly an important time. As we've mentioned right now, the House is taking up a war financing bill today. The new nominee to be head of the Central Command has a nomination today. And while I agree with Representative Harmon, I think both of these will go through. I think what this does, just as the firing of General McChrystal did, was focus the nation and the world's attention again on Afghanistan in a major way. And I'd also like to underscore the point that's been brought up by my colleagues, and that the material on the Pakistani spy service, the ISI, while we and other news organizations have written about this, the detail and the telling detail, incident after incident, even if you discard some of these as the work of paid informants or Afghan intelligence who have a bias against the Pakistani ISI, just the details of meetings that ISI representatives sat in with the Afghan Taliban, the organization that they are allegedly having with setting up suicide bombers and even assassination attempts, this, again, raises serious policy questions. The United States reimburses Pakistan more than $1 billion a year to fund the troops that Pakistan puts on the border, ostensibly for counterterrorism purposes. This is at the same time, then, that that country's spy agency is actively supporting the militants that the United States is fighting in Afghanistan. This raises serious policy questions.
John McLaughlin, do you agree? Raises serious policy questions.
Well, you know, anyone who has trouble with ambiguity should not deal with the Pakistan problem or with the Pakistani intelligence service. And we've known for some time that this is a service, largely because of the concerns that Pakistan has with India. It's complicated. Pursues multiple objectives, multiple interests simultaneously.
Not all of which square with American
not
national interests.
Not all of which square with American national interests. But, you know, a mature relationship with them acknowledges that, understands it, but at the same time seeks areas of common interest with them where you can work with people that the U.S. intelligence community pretty carefully vets on discrete particular interests. And I think we're able to do that pretty well while putting pressure on them to be more consistent in their views, but understanding also that they live in a part of the world we don't live in.
Yes, John Barry.
The whole debate about Pakistan seems to me to be occasionally fantastical. I mean, people ask whose side is Pakistan on? And the answer is, of course, Pakistan's on Pakistan's side, just as America's on America's side. And I think if you look back over now a decade since 9/11 of the relationship of the U.S. to Pakistan, and particularly to the intelligence services, it becomes reasonably clear, I think, that Pakistan's willingness to help correlates very closely, when you go back over it, to Pakistan's perception of the willingness of the U.S. to stay around in Afghanistan so that Pakistan isn't left on its own to cope with the consequences as it was after the U.S. withdrew following the Soviet withdrawal in 78-79. It does seem to me that you can look at this relationship as it's waxed and waned. What now, I think, there's increasing evidence, is that the Pakistan government believes the U.S. is going to get out, and it believes that because President Obama said it, and is taking steps to look to the situation after America's withdrawal, as indeed all the regional actors are.
Which would argue from their point of view, at least in the minds of some, to continue their connections in Afghanistan to protect their own interests once the American leaves.
Yes.
Right. Eric, I want to get to the question that John McLaughlin raised, and Jane Harmon did too, about the responsibility of the news media. You were part of this team, and people have made a distinction between the documents posted on WikiLeaks, these rather raw information. New York Times, in its own, your boss, Bill Keller, and others have tried to say, look, we were very careful. We did excise names of informants, details about operations, the kind of information that the bad guys could use in the future. Talk about that process that the New York Times went through. A lot of people think that news organizations just publish anything without consulting or scrutinizing it. But enlighten our listeners as to what you went through.
Sure. I was sent over to London about a month ago when we first were made aware that we could have access to these documents. They were an electronic database that was being shared with the two other publications, The Guardian of Britain and Der Spiegel of Germany. To do an initial vetting of those documents, and I did so, and determined that there was definitely things worth pursuing here. But we needed help, and so we had the database transferred back to New York, and with the help of several of my colleagues who follow this in Afghanistan and Pakistan and in Washington, as well as some superb analysts in our computer-assisted reporting division, we were able to sift through this information and categorize it and analyze it journalistically. Once we felt we had our arms around some of the major themes of this reporting, we then looked and we started to write our stories up. We also started looking at the information that we thought would be sensitive, as you said, names of informants on the ground, sources and methods that the military might object to. Much of this information, however, was dated. There were operations that were several years old. Again, these are summary reports, incident reports, raw intelligence, things that may not have much bearing right now. Nonetheless, we did our best in going through. We made a decision. We weren't going to post all the documents. We would post a sampling of them so people could see what we were talking about. We went through them with great care with our lawyers and also consulted the Pentagon, the CIA, and the White House. And I think the White House has acknowledged our role in the due diligence that we took in taking care of these documents. This was also a step that our colleagues in Britain and Germany were going through. And the three of us also impressed upon Julian Assange, the founder of WikiLeaks, that the significance of what he was intending to do, which was just to put all these documents out initially. I think we may have had some impression on him because he has announced that they have withheld some 15,000 documents so far to go through a similar redaction process.
You've been through these conversations, Mr. McLaughlin, in your many years at the CIA. Do you feel that the New York Times and these other news organizations did handle this material responsibly, or are you concerned about the judgments that they made?
Well, there are many occasions in my professional life when I had to deal with newspapers that had material like this.
And people don't realize these conversations go on all the time.
You would get calls from them, and they would tell you what they had, and you would have a discussion, a debate at times. And sometimes, from our point of view, we'd win, and sometimes we'd lose. I believe that major newspapers try to wrestle with these issues responsibly. And in the case of this particular leak, the way it's handled, I think the Times, in terms of what they actually published, did a pretty good job of abstracting, taking out of it the things that can be truly harmful. Now, the broader question to me is, should any of this be happening?
Mm-hmm.
One of their big societal issues going on here. This wouldn't have happened 30 years ago. You wouldn't have had the technology to do this in the volume that it was done now. The intelligence community is now in a mode, rightly, of sharing information broadly, deeply, right down to the bottom of the pyramid, because that's what you have to do in a counterinsurgency. There is
sharing it with allies,
sharing
and other intelligence
allies,
services.
Sharing it up and down the chain of command.
Which raises the possibility of leaks.
And it also forces everyone in that chain of command to be more responsible about it. I also think with documents like this, it's hard to make public policy judgments. If you'd gone, say, to 1943 and World War II and pushed out a comparable series of reports, you wouldn't have had a very pretty picture, and you would have made judgments about the outcome of World War II that would have been quite distorted in the eye of history.
John Barry, you've been involved in many of these cases where, as a defense correspondent, you've had information. How do you strike the balance as someone who's been through many of these decisions? What are the considerations that go through your mind when you get information of this kind that you might think is valuable to your readers but also might have a side effect?
The classic considerations of what damage does it do to people, revelation of sources, and what damage does it do to ongoing and existing security interests that are important. Then you consult with, as John McLaughlin has said, you consult with the relevant agencies. There isn't a hard and fast rule, which is why it's so difficult. It comes down to a matter of judgment.
And what was your take on the balance struck by the Times and these other two organizations?
I thought that I haven't read the Spiegel one in detail. I mean, I sort of skimmed it, but didn't read it. I thought that they handled it very well and did, as Eric said, redact large parts of it. The problem, of course, is that the basic WikiLeaks dump doesn't redact a great amount of things that the New York Times and the Guardian did.
I'm Steve Roberts. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now, on this very subject, I want to bring in by phone Jeff Jarvis. He's professor of interactive journalism at City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism and someone who's written a great deal about exactly what you're talking about, Mr. McLaughlin, the impact of modern technology on the media universe. So, Jeff Jarvis, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. Great discussion.
I want to get your take on the subject raised by Mr. McLaughlin, as well as by my two journalists here. Are we dealing in a different world in terms of information dissemination, and what's the significance of that change?
Oh, of course we are. And I think especially in a leaked priority or leaked context, someone can get data from more places now, and they can spread it around the world without the mediator of media. What's fascinating to me is the fact that WikiLeaks chose to go through a medium with The Guardian, Times, and Der Spiegel. And I think what that says to us is that journalism does, thank goodness, add value. It makes us ask, what's the value we really add? But in the case of WikiLeaks, they wanted more attention to it, and so they wanted media properties to pay proper attention and get attention for it. It also is very true that the media properties, I think, were going to do a more responsible job of figuring out what to excise, what to curate, and could present it better. And so I think that there's what this tells us. Alan Rusbridger at The Guardian talks about the mutualization of news. Mm-hmm. Says that more and more news will become collaborative because you don't have to go through us and we have to figure out where our value is.
But one of the interesting clashes here, the New York Times, as Eric described, went through a very careful process. I assume The Guardian and Der Spiegel did too. But and was faced with an organization with a very different culture, WikiLeaks, which, as he described, their initial impulse was to put everything out there and therefore raise the possibility of revealing secrets and information that could be damaging. And it's really at the we've seen a very interesting example of these two new cultures, right?
Absolutely, and I think they're very complementary. I asked, in preparation for the show, I asked Alan Rusbridger, the editor of The Guardian, this morning, whether he thinks that The Guardian should have started WikiLeaks. Should they have had that vehicle themselves? Mm-hmm. And he said no, because WikiLeaks is going to do things that The Guardian wouldn't or couldn't do, and vice versa. And also The Guardian and The Times and Der Spiegel are better targets for government or companies. And so what this says is that there is a new and independent role for people who are going to find information, whether that's from the Department of Defense or whether that's from your local town council. There'll be advocates and leakers and all kinds of new people there, and we as journalists will not be the conduit because we own the distribution anymore. We'll be the ones who, again, add value.
But does it also raise the question, if you go through the New York Times with a long history, or Newsweek, John Barry's organization, long history of, as John McLaughlin described, of an ongoing relationship with the intelligence services, a sense of responsibility, when you get an organization like WikiLeaks, which doesn't have the same history, doesn't have the same ethic standards, and as Eric described, even the administration asked the New York Times to go to WikiLeaks and say, be more responsible. What does that tell you about the dangers inherent in an organization like WikiLeaks, which doesn't have the same code of ethics or the same sense of responsibility to national security?
It says to me that the best weapon against leaks is transparency, and that the more the government is open with our information, the better off they're going to be. The government's not in a position anymore to be the censor that they were. And so I think that they create more of a need for leaks the more they hide. And one thing we've heard about this story is that there isn't a lot new here. It's confirming what we knew. It's validating what we knew. Well, then that means it's information that we should have known. I think what we see here is we see more and more unaffiliated journalists. The journalists aren't with the organization. They can do acts of journalism, maybe not under the standards of journalism, but they're going to reveal things on their own. And so we're in an entirely new world of transparency now that I think we see in our personal lives with Facebook and so on, and we see with the requirement we're going to put on government and companies to be far more transparent than they are. So Obama has made some nice moves toward transparency and revealing who walks through the front gate. That's very nice, but that ain't nothing compared to what we're going to have to do in government to be very, very transparent.
That's Jeff Jarvis. He teaches journalism, interactive journalism at City University of New York. Also with me, Eric Schmidt of the New York Times, John Barry of Newsweek, and John McLaughlin, who is a former acting director of the CIA. We're going to be back with your calls, your emails, your comments on this very interesting question, so you stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Vicki and Roger Sant and Island Press, which offers solutions to environmental problems in print, in person, and online at islandpress.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.
Astronaut Sally Ride was the first American woman in space. Today, she's on a new mission to make science cool for kids, especially girls. How she plans to encourage students to prepare for careers in science, technology, engineering, and math. The Diane Rehm Show next hour. Welcome back. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane. Our subject this hour, the massive release of documents relating to the Afghan war in the New York Times and other publications in the last day or two. Eric Schmidt is with me. He's one of the New York Times reporters who worked on this project. John McLaughlin, former acting director of the CIA. John Barry, defense correspondent for Newsweek. And on the phone from New York, Jeff Jarvis, who teaches journalism at City University. And Mr. McLaughlin, give us your take on a question that's been raised by a lot of people. Daniel Ellsberg, the man who was responsible for the leaks of the Pentagon Papers, drew a lot of parallels. Others have said there's not a lot of parallels. I actually worked for the New York Times during the Pentagon Papers case and was involved in some of the coverage, including covering Ellsberg's trial in California. And I'm wondering your take. How do you compare the two incidents?
I don't see any similarity at all. The Pentagon Papers represented a study that the Defense Department had done internally, a very analytic study that turned out, when revealed, to be somewhat at odds with the public commentary of the U.S. government. That was the big news. This is totally different. This is not an assessment. This is a compilation of raw reports of varying reliability, the kind of thing that lands on a typical intelligence officer's desk every day to make sense out of. So I don't see any real comparison, other than the fact that we're talking about two wars about which there are there's significant public debate and some disaffection.
Eric, within the New York Times, was there any conversation about the parallels here? What's your take, having been through this editorial process?
Yeah, I'm sure it came up just because of the history the New York Times has with the Pentagon Papers, but it became very clear to us early on these were not the Pentagon Papers for the reason John has just described. That said, however, you do have this incredible volume of reports. That's one thing there is perhaps some comparison to, just the sheer volume, 92,000 incident reports landing, and the impact of that volume falling at a time when you have the public challenging an unpopular war. So perhaps there's some parallel in that political sense.
And Jeff Jarvis, what's your take on all the commentary about the parallels to the Pentagon Papers?
Well, Daniel Ellsberg said yesterday to the Wall Street Journal that he's been waiting for this to happen for 40 years. And in a sense, what makes me ask is, if the Internet had existed, how would Ellsberg have operated differently? Maybe he wouldn't have. Maybe just like WikiLeaks, he would have gone through the New York Times. And yes, the material itself is different. The circumstances of how it's gotten is different. But I think that it's an acceleration of what Ellsberg did that shows us that there's going to be more of this coming up, and it's not necessarily a bad thing as long as it's handled with some measure of responsibility.
You know, I do remember, because it came out in Ellsberg's trial that I covered, endless hours spent Xeroxing copies, paper copies of the Pentagon Papers, and having to smuggle paper documents out and hand them over to the New York Times. One of the striking and obvious differences here, as you've written many times, is that that process has now been virtually eliminated.
In terms of who can get to the data, how it can be analyzed, how it can be copied, and how it can be distributed, yes, that all changes radically. The thing that I wonder about, though, as we also go after government to enable, for example, all emails to be public, does it mean that we're going to write down less? I think that's where the peril lies. Is we'll find that more will happen over the, you know, voice conversations on the phone to keep it out of writing, which we know happens to an extent now. And if everything is transparent, which I basically want to happen, it also means that we make it less transparent in other ways.
Jeff Jarvis, thank you so much. You're professor of interactive journalism at City University of New York. We appreciate you being with us on the Diane Rehm Show this morning.
Thanks.
Let me read a couple of Facebook comments that we've gotten. John Barry, this is... Joseph Spicone writes to us, given the implications to national security, troop safety, et cetera, a story like this has, is there anything media outlets won't capitalize, won't publish? Or is getting the story the only thing they care about?
I think that's a very good question, and I think the answer is quite unclear. I mean, the next crisis that I see is, let us say hypothetically that WikiLeaks or someone has another batch of documents which relate to the operations of American Special Forces, the Special Force Task Force 373 in Afghanistan. And let's say they dump that. Well, what do the mainstream media do? Do they ignore it all? Do they say, well, it's out there, we're not going to tell you quite what it is, but in publicizing its existence, they encourage people to go to the site? I think that's the next challenge we're going to face, and I have no idea how the media are going to react.
And in fact, we're starting to hear stories that there is another cache of documents about Iraq that could come online pretty soon, right? John McLaughlin?
You know, there's a danger here that we need to flag, and that is this is a time when, for effective public policy on terrorism and other things, insurgency, we really need to share information up and down the line. There could be an impulse here to pull back, to tighten up, if the danger that John Barry mentioned is real, because of that concern about everything going out the door, particularly on names of people, sources, adversaries, friends,
right,
and so forth.
Now
that would be a bad thing.
You know, we've got a lot of emails on the in and around this question of the role of the press and the damage, potential damage of not only these leaks but others in the future. As you point out, John, this is probably not the end of this. Let me read at least one of them from Peter Conrad. And Eric, I'd like your response. I am a government student at Georgetown University. I must say that I agree with the administration is saying, that this leak is ultimately irresponsible. I did a research paper on the war in Afghanistan last semester, and what I find odd is that there are a few experts who do not believe that there is some connection between the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, and the Taliban, whether historical or contemporary. So the content of the leak is relatively unsurprising. My question is about WikiLeaks itself. Can we trust an independent organization to vet secret information to prevent potential national security risks? What do you think, Eric?
No. That's why you need the press. That's why you need institutions like Newsweek and the New York Times and the Washington Post and CBS and other news to look at this. And that's why I think we provided the public a great service here. And I think what I worry about is whether it's WikiLeaks or some other organization takes their next document dump and just spills all the marbles on the floor, and we're all scurrying around with nobody who's had a chance to give it a thorough vetting, and we're all just kind of writing off the top of our heads. I think that's where you're going to veer, because it'd be competitive pressures where you're going to start to veer into kind of irresponsible journalism.
And as you point out, you had a full month to not only go through and analyze the importance of the documents, but also to make these judgments about what kind of information could be sensitive or damaging.
Well, and to vet it with people who know this subject quite well. We took some of these examples to senior military commanders in the field, retired military intelligence analysts, and say, what do you make of this? Do you recognize this? Can you independently corroborate this? And so it wasn't.
And did you also ask the question, would this be a security risk if we release this information?
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Absolutely did that as well.
Very interesting. Let's go to some of our callers who are anxious to join us. And Lydia in Los Angeles, welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you. I have a question, but before that, I would like to add that yesterday I heard Daniel Ellsberg say that had there been a WikiLeaks in his time, that he would have hoped that he would have released the documents sooner, and he encouraged people now to take up his example and others, and when they had some information that they felt would be of general interest, to release it to WikiLeaks.
So what's on your mind, Lydia?
My question is, I find it interesting that the White House would use the word responsible and set itself up as the arbiters of what is and isn't, you know, a responsible release of information when it seems it's not, all of this discussion isn't balanced by a discussion of how responsible is our policy, our military policy right now in Afghanistan, when we're letting, when some of these examples come out that have been emphasized in Europe but not in the United States about killing of civilians.
Okay, Lydia, thank you very much. John Barry, did you see a difference in the focus of the coverage? It has been noted, as Lydia says, that the European reports focused more on the civilian casualty dimension.
Yes, it was very striking. Spiegel focused on the German angle, looking for stories of the German contingent in the north of Afghanistan. And the Guardian focused really quite heavily on the allegations of civilian casualties. I must say, reading the material, I wasn't at all clear, actually, that there was any significant new material about civilian casualties. I think it was, 144 incidents with, 170 dead or something, which, of course, is far smaller than the totals that are actually acknowledged by US and NATO commanders. So I wasn't sure that there was anything really new in the reports of civilian casualties. But it is true that the Europeans have played that up.
Let me turn to Jennifer in Olympia, Washington. Welcome. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Oh, thank you, Steve. You know, I wanted to mention a couple of things about the media right now, and you all were discussing this earlier, and you mentioned the big key, transparency. You know, I feel like when I turn on the news, it's just so sensationalist these days. No one's really getting the right information. No one's really talking about anything. It's so scary to me. And while there was no real new information besides two names and cities and whatnot, you know, what WikiLeaks got us to do is talk about it. You know, talk about the war, have discussions about it, because that's what we need, our discussions. We're so wrapped up in, oh, blame the Republicans, blame the Democrats, it's the Bush administration, it's the Obama administration, but no one's really talking about real issues, and nothing's really getting done. So I'm really glad that this happened, because now people are talking about it.
Jennifer, thank you so much for your call. Eric, do you sense that this will, you know, when we talked to Jane Harman, she mentioned that there is a defense appropriation bill coming through Congress, and there will be other checkpoints that will raise some of these issues. You What's your reaction to her comments about raising the public visibility of this issue?
I think it does. And I think, as I mentioned before, I think the firing of General McChrystal put a spotlight on it. I think what it also does is compress an already tight time schedule for General Petraeus in the field as well as policymakers here in Washington. General Petraeus has until December to come up with basically an update of the assessment of how things are going prior to the scheduled July 2011 date when U.S. troops are scheduled to begin withdrawal. I think these kind of revelations just focus the public's attention and will accelerate this process toward a decision one way or the other and where how to proceed in Afghanistan.
I'm Steve Roberts, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's turn to Jeff in Columbia, Maryland. Jeff, you're on the air. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to mention that the publication of this stuff has really changed my attitude about the war, where previously I was a supporter of the war. Now I'm coming around to what I used to think was kind of a radical view, that what we should have treated this as is not a war, but as a criminal act. And we should have gone in with the intent or purpose of just capturing Osama bin Laden and sort of, you know, not tried to go into this whole thing of setting up a new Afghan government and rehabilitating the whole society and trying to, put an American footprint on a basically foreign place. That's my only comment.
Thank you. John McLaughlin, reaction?
Well, I think we have to be careful not to let, a number of the callers correctly say this has stimulated public discussion, probably a good thing. But we have to be careful not to come to premature judgments about the course of the Afghan war at this point. We all know the problems. General Petraeus has just taken over. Again, every war I've looked at, if you tap into a deep series of reports halfway through it or into it, you're going to get a mixed message. One of the problems here, I think, is with a data dump like this, as much as the press needs to inform the public, I would think a lot of people wonder, what is it I can believe?
Mm-hmm.
What can I believe out of all of this when every man can be the fourth estate these days with technology permitting that?
So, do you have a sense that one of the results here is more pressure on the White House to explain themselves? When you get 53% of the American public saying the war is not worth it and the president is saying it is worth it, there's a disconnect there.
Oh, I believe that pressure was there anyway. This may accelerate it a bit, but I think everyone in the administration feels that pressure, and certainly everyone knows. I think there's no doubting that this is a difficult situation, probably the most complicated thing we've seen in decades.
We have time for perhaps one more caller. Russell in Dallas, Texas, we're delighted to have you with us. What's on your mind?
I appreciate that. I wanted to know where the line gets drawn between information that can be released to the public and what's considered espionage by the government. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense. Eric, obviously, you mentioned that the New York Times went to its lawyers in part of the preparation. What's your reaction to it?
Well, again, we parse this very closely, and we come across information that we think could jeopardize national security and certainly jeopardize lives on the ground, whether they be American service members or, in this case, Afghan informants or people come forward. We are very closely weighing that publication versus those national security interest, and then we consult with the government. We go to the government and say, this is what we have, this is what we intend to publish. Tell us why that would jeopardize either policies, procedures, or people on the ground.
Now, John Barry, it's also true that there is a distinction between the people who provide this information, who release secret information, who could be subject to prosecution under the Espionage Act and other statutes, as opposed to the publication, which the Pentagon Papers case, the Supreme Court pretty clearly ruled it against any attempt by the government to censor it. But help our listeners understand the distinction.
Espionage is a technical term, so let's stay away from that. It is true that journalists individually have, on the whole, since the Pentagon Papers, been immune from prosecution. And that the law enforcement agencies have gone after the leakers. Whether that will continue to be the case is unclear to me. I think it's obvious that the Obama administration is fairly exercised about not just this leak, but the whole series of leaks that have come.
And hasn't that been true of every administration in the history of the world?
My sense, actually, is that this administration is more worried than for instance, the previous administration was.
Interesting. John McLaughlin, your take on this issue quickly.
Well, you know, I think journalists have tough calls to make. I think there are certain things that most responsible journalists would put off limits. For example, if they came up with the names of all of CIA's sources in country X, most journalists would say, off limits, that can't be published. On the other hand, if you came across a classified paper that described loose security at a nuclear power plant in, pick a state, Delaware, classified paper, that's probably moving into a gray area that makes it harder for a newspaper to decide what to do because public safety is involved and so forth. My point is, when lives are involved, when strategy is involved, when the decisions you're making about an adversary that we all agree on are involved, that's off limits.
That's got to be the final word. It's John McLaughlin. He was the former acting director of the CIA. Also with me this morning, Eric Schmidt covers terrorism for the New York Times and was part of the team that broke this story this week. And John Barry, veteran defense correspondent for Newsweek. Also thanks to Jane Harmon, representative from California, who is on the heads of the subcommittee on Homeland Security on the Intelligence Committee, and Jeff Jarvis, who teaches journalism at City University of New York. I'm Steve Roberts, sitting in today for Diane Miles. She's away on vacation, and I'm grateful you spent an hour with us this morning. Thank you.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones.